Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Every year, thousands of people come to the U.S. from other countries. Some, like me, come here as immigrants. I will never forget arriving in Philadelphia in the 90s. I came from Germany, and I was trying to navigate my way through the immigration lines at the airport, and an officer eventually asked me, "How can I help you?" And I said, "I would like to immigrate, please." And that made him laugh. And he said, "Well, I hope you have some paperwork for that," which I did. So then I had to go to a small office, and there I submitted my visa, and the officers on duty were all talking to each other and joking, and I couldn't really understand them. It was very confusing for me. But eventually I got my stamps and I was on my way. My story was a happy one, but many, many people come to this country under terrible circumstances. They come here seeking refuge. Not all of them meet the complicated legal definition of refugee, but they're still seeking refuge here from terror, torture, war, famine, economic difficulties, oppression.
A refuge in Algerian is malja.
In Vietnamese, the word refuge is châu tị nạn.
Refuge is убежище.
Refugio.
We say refugio
in Hunzi.
In Arabic, refuge is laje.
I'm from Afghanistan. In Farsi, refuge is panahi.
In Swahili, refuge means kimbizi.
With the Trump administration's policies attempting to slow the flow of immigrants and refugees coming to this country, it seems like we've all been paying more attention to the experiences of people who come here to start new lives, what they've been through, and what their needs are once they get here. So that's what we'll talk about on today's show. We'll meet people as they interact with the American medical system for the first time. We'll follow doctors who care for refugees here and abroad. And we'll find out about the lives and legal perils of climate migrants. Our first story is told by a new doctor, Avir Mitra. He is training as an emergency room specialist in New York City, and a while back, he met a patient at his hospital, a young man from Jamaica, and that man told him a story that has had a big impact on Avir and how he practices medicine, and he wanted to introduce him to us.
Meet Malcolm. He was living in Jamaica in 2012, and on this particular night, he was heading home from work in a shared taxi with a bunch of strangers.
Apparently, there was somebody in the taxi who wanted to rob the car or something.
The man pulled out a gun. He ordered everyone out of the car.
Now, when I got out of the car, all of his attention now started to focus on me. He left everybody else. He had the gun on me because when I walked out, he realized that I was gay. He immediately pointed the gun at me and said, and then he just like, "I didn't know a fish was in here."
Fish is a derogatory term used to harass and insult gay men. Malcolm says he's worried this story could make his family in Jamaica unsafe, so he asked that we don't use his real name. He's in his mid-20s now, but let's step back, rewind all the way back to his childhood in a small town in St. Anne Parish. Malcolm says everyone knew everyone in his town, and everyone knew he was gay.
I talked very squeaky, for example. Like some would say, you talk like a girl. The way how I walk, I would look at other boys my age, like, I don't look like that. And it's sort of wishing to be normal.
Being Malcolm's kind of different, though, is tough in Jamaica, says Sarah Hamilton. She's a human rights lawyer for Amnesty International.
And I am Jamaican myself. Jamaica is a deeply religious and Christian country. And I think 70% of Jamaicans identify as evangelical Christian. There's widespread belief that homosexuality is actually against the laws of God and is seen as a threat to their religion. And as a threat to religion, it's a threat to their identity.
Malcolm says as a boy, strangers in the street would hiss threatening words at him. In school, he was bullied. He told his teachers at first, but eventually stopped complaining because no one helped. He felt afraid. He had nightmares. Even the dancehall music that was popular when Malcolm was a teenager was full of homophobic slurs.
My dogs set rules, set laws.
It's very normal for you to go to a session, like a dance or whatever, and people will be, like, they have these aerosol cans, and they will use a lighter, and they will spray the fire out when these songs come on, because that's a symbol that people who are gay used to be burned. Name calling, people saying, like, people like you must die, you don't deserve to live.
And it wasn't empty talk. One evening, Malcolm was walking home from classes, and he was attacked by a group of men.
They did a number on me. They beat me really bad. They dragged me into the little alley, and they were calling me names, going on and on and on. They punched me. They kicked me on the ground. They beat me really bad.
So he did what most of us would do.
I went to the police station, and I told them what happened. And the cop, he looked at me and said, "That is what you deserve." That's exactly what he said to me. And I went into a public restroom and I cleaned myself up and then I went home.
At that moment, Malcolm realized the police wouldn't protect him. No one was going to protect him.
Even if somebody tries to stand up for you, then they go against that person. They're like, "Oh, you're trying to protect this gay man from us. Are you gay too?"
In fact, anti-gay prejudice is written into Jamaican law. A colonial-era rule criminalizes male intercourse, and LGBT activists say talk of jail time and prison is used to intimidate people. And then in 2006, a Time magazine headline asked if Jamaica was maybe the most homophobic place on Earth. Writer and activist Suzanne Persard keeps tabs on Jamaica.
So I'm a queer Jamaican American woman. Yeah, I'm actually a kid from of Jamaican parents. I was born and raised in New York City, and my parents are from Kingston.
The country's track record of homophobic violence is clear, but Persard says it's also time to update Jamaica's image. When activists held the country's first public pride celebration in 2015, the Minister of Justice urged Jamaicans to respect the event.
You have more people coming out and, various organizations are coming out in support of, LGBT rights as a basic tenet of human rights. A lot of LGBT activism on the ground has been happening, and that's definitely something that I think a lot of people are surprised to learn about, given the media portrayals of Jamaica as this country that has machete-wielding mobs.
So Jamaica's story has evolved. But Malcolm, who was bullied as a boy and taunted as a teen, says as he grew older, Jamaica got worse for him. Fast forward a couple years, and Malcolm is where we met him at the top of this story, with a gun to his head, singled out for being gay.
He put the gun in my face, and I was trying to get away. And I'm not really entirely sure what happened after that. He gun-butted me, and then he shot me.
Knocked unconscious and bleeding from his leg, Malcolm eventually came to, lying on the side of the street. He spent several weeks recovering from the gunshot wound and a brain injury. Depressed, he felt he might take his own life, or eventually someone else would. So Malcolm left Jamaica. He used a tourist visa to travel to the United States, but he actually had no intention of returning. Little money, no job, he arrived in New York City. Specifically, Elmhurst, Queens. Walking out of the subway, it seems like everyone is speaking a different language here. A Spanish bodega butts up against a Korean grocery store, which is filled with Bengalis. I'm a new doctor, and I'm doing part of my residency in Queens, and that's where I met Malcolm. At first, he was reserved and nervous. It took a while, but eventually he opened up and told me just how scary it was for him growing up in Jamaica.
It's constant, it's every day, it's been a nightmare for the entire 20 odd years. I don't know what it is to live.
Denali Fernando introduced us. She's one of my supervising doctors in the emergency department. And Elmhurst Hospital, where we work, cares for lots of people who are new to America. A lot of people just like Malcolm who are undocumented.
Uninsured, underinsured, and so they end up utilizing the ED as their primary source of entry into the healthcare systems, the portal of entry.
Hospital leaders wanted to know more about the immigrants who came through the ER, so they surveyed 500 patients and asked two questions.
Well, you have a threat or harm by groups such as the government, police, military, or rebel soldiers. And the second question was, some people in your situation have experienced torture. Has this ever happened to you or your family?
Nearly 7% of the patients said yes, they had experienced some form of torture. That may sound small, but our ER has 90,000 patient visits every year.
And I just did a shift in that ER today. That means at least one or two of those people that were in the ER today
could well have been torture survivors. Yep.
Wow.
When the doctors realized that, they started work on a project that later became the Libertas Center for Human Rights. It's an ER-based program, and Denali Fernando is the current medical director. Eventually, Malcolm made his way to their offices, tucked away in a quiet old part of the hospital.
Yes.
At Libertas, he learned he wasn't just a victim of a hate crime.
I'm planning on meeting with the billing department.
Remember when Malcolm spoke to his teachers, when he went to the police? Malcolm says they looked the other way, and at least in one instance, authorities condoned violence against him. Dr. Fernando says Malcolm's experiences make him a torture survivor, according to the United Nations and United States definitions.
If there are no systems in place to protect you, or the systems that are in place don't offer protection, then you will qualify.
The center links asylum seekers with medical care, counseling, and a caseworker. The plan is to help Malcolm get well as he works to gain legal status in the U.S. It's a long, winding process that means talking with attorneys and sharing ugly details from the past. Dr. Fernando did a forensic evaluation of Malcolm, a medical and psychological exam, and later wrote an affidavit to support his asylum case.
The case for asylum is that you cannot return to your home country because if you go, your life will be in danger.
The Libertas Center is studying the people it serves and their interactions with our healthcare system.
But the most interesting piece of data, I think, 72% of these patients never had a physician ask them about their torture.
In medicine, they say you'll only find something if you're looking for it. And doctors like me simply weren't looking. We weren't asking the right questions.
I mean, I've never asked anyone about... I wouldn't even know how to ask that. That just seems very, like, weird. Like, how do you... You know, how do you go up to someone? So are you tortured? Like, I can imagine a lot of people be like, what are you talking about? Like,
yeah.
No.
You know, I think part of it is just to weave it into your conversation. And so if they say they're from a country where you know it's a country where there's a lot of political turmoil and harm, that can be something to kind of initiate the conversation. And then when you're doing the physical exam on the patient, if you see scars, you can ask them, oh, I see these scars, what is this from?
Well, now I'm on the lookout. There are centers like Libertas at Bellevue Hospital in New York City, another in Minneapolis, and about 30 other places across the country. Malcolm's asylum papers have been filed, but it can take 3 or 4 years before you get a hearing before a judge. Until then, Malcolm's living in legal limbo, waiting his turn.
This is my home, so I can't picture myself living anywhere else right now.
Physician Avir Mitra reported this story with help from Alex Stern. Avir is completing training as an ER specialist in New York City. This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott, and our show today is about seeking refuge. Meeting the formal definition of refugee is very difficult. It typically requires a lengthy process. There's a legal document, it's called the 1951 Refugee Convention, that countries around the world have accepted, and it defines who is a refugee, and it also outlines refugee rights. We're talking about people who were persecuted for their race, their religion, which social group they belonged to, and so on. More than 85,000 people came to the U.S. last year as refugees, and about a third of them are children. They're usually accompanied by their parents, and often one of the first things moms and dads want to take care of in this new world is checking on their kids' health. Reporter Alana Gordon caught up with a Syrian refugee family for their first health exam, and she gives us this glimpse.
For 4 years now, the pediatric wing at Einstein Health in North Philadelphia has blocked off Thursday mornings to meet with refugee families.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning. How are you?
On this day, they're prepping to meet the Tawils. The family of five is all together in a spacious exam room. Four-year-old Anas scopes out me and my microphone. Then he stands up in his little green scrubs and puffs out his little chest. Linda Case, the Arabic interpreter for their visit, is also moved by this act of utter cuteness.
Wow, this is a song, a very long song that he learned probably in school.
The Tawils are from Syria, where the husband's family ran restaurants and some other businesses. That little singing one, Anas, was still developing in mom's belly when their neighborhood in the southern countryside was bombed.
I was not only worrying about my pregnancy, but about all the kids, all my neighbors, my family. All the pictures that you may have watched on TV are really real.
They fled their home in the middle of the night with Anas's big brother, 18-month-old Ghassan. They settled first in Damascus, where Anas was eventually born. They said it was safer there, but still the war raged around them. A close family member had been arrested and imprisoned. Within a year, the family moved to Egypt, where they hoped it would be safer. There, they applied for help from a refugee organization.
And one day, the organization contacted us and asked whether we wanted to be resettled in another country, like the United States. And we said yes. So after a year and a half of interviews and meetings, we were able to get the papers as refugees.
Okay. Do you feel safer here now?
Dr. Raghava Kavala has heard stories like these before.
It's very touching to see these kids here. I'm glad you are safe.
She talks through an interpreter to the dad and mom, and then begins the children's exams, starting with the youngest, Nejwa. She's 10 months.
I can see that she rolled over just now. Is she able to sit when you hold her?
She reviews the kids' growth, diet, and other development markers. Then she reviews their dental health. It's something that's often neglected. Everything looks good so far. Here in this exam room, signs that their family may have been through more than anyone would want to imagine are subtle. The two young boys curiously look on, wide-eyed, during the visit. They're smiling and are even amenable to having their body prodded a little. But the mom, Enas, says the sight of blood, even when getting their own drawn, can be upsetting.
Now, when they see blood, they get scared.
The father, Osama, says war is a distant memory for his children, and he's doing his best to help them forget.
Now, the only thing they remember about their country is the name.
Dr. Kavala says kids respond to trauma differently at different ages. Staff keep an eye out for signs of nightmares, withdrawing from activities. For young ones, play therapy and distraction is really helpful. They say a key to addressing this and other health issues is developing a good rapport and relationship with families.
Sticking out and say, ah, like a crocodile.
Ah. Ah.
Over the next 30 minutes or so, Dr. Kavala checks the kids' ears, throat, and reflexes. Next time, they'll do a vision and hearing test. Dad, Osama, says he's grateful.
Everything is very different. This is the best welcoming.
For the next 3 to 6 months, the Tawils are set up with a health coordinator who will help them get appointments. Staff here say that can be critical because families might not call out of fear that no one will understand them. Others might not realize that to get medicine at a pharmacy or to see a specialist, you first have to go through a primary care doctor. Things are different in the U.S. compared to other places. Except one thing.
No, we're going to walk them over to the vaccine room.
Okay, yeah.
Vaccines. This is routine for families like the Tawils. Before the war, Syria had a national immunization program. Staff give them information in Arabic about their kids' vaccine schedule. They'll need them to get their kids into school. But nothing is cool about it for Nejwa, Ghassan, or that previously happy 4-year-old vocalist, Anas. Staff at this refugee clinic say there's an increased level of stress and anxiety among patients here these days, given all the heightened national policies looking to restrict immigration and refugees. Many of the doctors here are immigrants themselves, including the clinic director, Dr. Mesa Abu Ali, who's from Saudi Arabia. But she says this work with refugee kids is immensely humbling and inspiring.
What's most striking about these refugee children is their incredible resilience. Because again, they come in fearful, and within a month, we see that they're speaking English fluently and they're excelling in school.
Time and again, she sees kids bouncing back to being kids, adapting to their new world. Within minutes of Anas bawling from that vaccine, he's sitting in the hallway, looking at his dad's phone. He's singing again, this time to a much more familiar American tune.
That was Alana Gordon reporting. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and our show today is about seeking refuge. And we just heard from doctors who care for refugees once they've arrived here in this country. But so many are living in camps all over the world. They have not found a permanent home yet. I met up with Lada Cherith. She is a doctor at Pennsylvania Hospital in Philadelphia, and she volunteered with the Syrian American Medical Society to treat refugees abroad. Her first trip in 2015 took her to Georgia. She said the camp she worked at was large, it was well-run, and then last year she traveled to Greece.
Greece was chaotic and very, very sad.
Over 60,000 refugees are stranded in Greece, and Cherith worked in a cluster of smaller camps where about 3,000 people were living in abandoned warehouses. She says there were only about two doctors per camp with volunteer translators.
So the people would just come. They would line up and they would come. We started giving them little passbooks, you know, so that we put their height and weight, and especially for the children, you know, we would put their height and weight. We would try to see if any of them had any record of vaccinations. And then, you know, it was a never-ceasing flow. So most of the things that we would see would be, you know, run-of-the-mill gastroenteritis or, you know, skin infections, lots of skin infections because of infected mosquito bites. And there would be chronic conditions like diabetes, hypertension.
If she had patients with serious problems, she could refer them to local hospitals, but there were massive language barriers.
We were English-speaking. The translators could translate English to Arabic because most of the residents in the camps were Arabic-speaking. The Greek physicians neither spoke English nor Arabic. So it was chaos. And they would write prescriptions in Greece and, you know, we would have no idea. It was chaos, you know.
Another problem was medications. When patients told her that they had taken different drugs for their conditions in Syria, she had no clue what exactly they were, so she had to do some guesswork, like with one patient who had very high blood pressure.
I had with me two classes of medications, and I would ask him, did either of them look familiar? He has no idea. Then I would like run through the list. Did he have allergic reactions to any of those? He had no idea. And then I would tell him, this is all that I have, and then he'll say, I'll take that. So yes, you know, we were limited, but I think the patients were very grateful. I think more than anything else, I felt that they needed someone to come over there and validate their existence, to show them that, you know, the rest of the world did care and, you know, they were not just left over there abandoned.
Many patients told her heartbreaking stories. One woman came in with her two daughters. The woman handed Cherith her patient passbook.
I open it, and on the first thing. It's written in block letters, suicide attempt.
Suicide attempt. The daughters had been translating up to that point, but then Cherith sent the kids out of the room.
So the girls left the room, and then I called the translator in. And then I was trying to speak to this woman, and I said, so why this suicide attempt? And then she breaks down crying, and then she says, yes, I did it. And then she's saying, not because I wanted to do it. I have three daughters, and I have a little son. She had four children. And then she said, do you think I would have done it? I know my daughters need me. But her husband was in Germany. He had already left. So she said, I thought that if I killed myself, my children would be regarded as unaccompanied minors, and they would be given first preference, so they would be able to get to Germany, which is why it was just devastating hearing them. And there were many days when we would cry.
She says her work in the refugee camps has had a lasting impact on her.
There were many nights when I could not sleep because you're tormented. You know, I'm not getting up tomorrow and I'm not going to these clinics again. I'm not going to be able to see that. And then you wonder about what happened. Did someone follow through with that patient? You know, those kinds of things. And it just tugs at you when you come back over here and you are back to your life of privilege and, you know, your freedom and your ability to take analgesics at, you know, like at the slightest thought of a pain or a headache. And over there, we would not even give them Tylenol or ibuprofen. You know, even that was rationed. So it tears at your insides.
Do you think you will do another mission?
Absolutely. Yeah. Without a doubt, yes.
Lata Cherith is an internist at Pennsylvania Hospital in Philadelphia, and last summer she spent time in Greece treating refugees. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. People migrate for all sorts of different reasons. War, persecution, poverty. Here's another reason, climate change. There are different organizations that track this, and they say millions are displaced every year due to climate or weather-related disasters. Think things like floods or droughts and land loss. Most people move internally within their countries. Others cross borders looking for a new home. But as Irina Zhorov reports, resettling those people who are fleeing climate change is not so easy.
The idea of climate migrants, climate refugees, if you will, has become mainstream. But Alice Thomas, who manages the climate displacement program at Refugees International, has a hard time pointing me to a climate refugee.
People ask me all the time, you know, I get interviews like, where are the climate refugees? You know, I want to go, which camp are they in?
She says climate change likely has a hand in the erratic rains, droughts, floods, and the displacement they cause, but it's rarely the only cause for movement.
Climate change impacts are interacting with other effects to drive people, you know, from their homes.
Ask a migrant, and most times they won't say climate change forced them to relocate. But, says Thomas, that's going to change. It's already changing. Take, for example, a case out of New Zealand. Lawyer Trevor Zeus represented a family that in 2007 left the tiny Pacific island nation of Tuvalu. It's hard to imagine wanting to leave the clear blue waters and sandy beaches of Tuvalu, but floods, saltwater intrusion, and storm surges were making life harder there. The family settled in New Zealand. In 2012, they sought permanent status. They claimed to be climate refugees. Zeus said that bid failed because legally, there's no such thing.
Of course, climate doesn't persecute directly.
The Refugee Convention protects specific groups of people persecuted by their government. But Tuvalu's government was doing everything it could to protect its people. It just couldn't fight rising seas.
The government of Tuvalu is every much a victim of climate change that are as its inhabitants.
Ultimately, the family appealed using a kind of workaround. They argued that their human rights would be violated if they were sent back to Tuvalu, both by the disruption in established relationships in New Zealand and the potential risk of exposing their children to bad water supplies in Tuvalu. They won. Of those who stayed, though, nearly every household on the tiny Pacific nations of Tuvalu, Kiribati, and Nauru has been impacted by climate change. The low-lying islands could drown and disappear altogether in the coming decades. In other words, more families will relocate, only to find there's no clear path forward for them.
We need a system, we need laws and institutions to be able to deal with this, and that doesn't exist in an... I don't know of one country where that there's an effective institution in place that's working or thinking about this.
That's Alice Thomas again with Refugees International. She says the human rights workaround used by the New Zealand family isn't a solution for others in their situation because human rights laws have no teeth. It's up to individual countries to choose if they want to implement international law and how.
An assumption that countries are going to suddenly open their arms widely for, you know, potential large numbers of people who are going to move is just...
It's just not happening, she says. One option is to draft an international document, like the Refugee Convention, specifically to cover climate migrants. That's unlikely. Such agreements take a lot of time and are politically fraught. And anyway, says Cosmin Karenda, a researcher at United Nations University, international conventions are reactive. Too late.
We already know how people are reacting. We already know that people, after a climate change scenario appears, they have two choices. They adapt or they flee.
Karenda says we should plan ahead instead.
Even if you stop today, the climate change process will go on. This is scientifically proven, but we can diminish the impacts of climate change upon people in different parts of the world differently. This is what I think we're missing in international law, preemptive measures.
Agreements to take in climate migrants, for example. Planned relocations in extreme cases like Tuvalu. He proposes regional agreements, where countries with similar needs and outlooks can coordinate. There have been some discussions among Pacific states for how to handle climate migrants, but nothing is in place yet. Whether the law exists or not, people are migrating.
It's not there yet visible. But it will be.
For The Pulse, I'm Irina Zhorov.
Coming up, a small taste of home can offer comfort to immigrants.
Is it true that we can get some eggplants here in the USA? It was so amazing.
A farmer's journey to bring the flavors of the Democratic Republic of the Congo here. Stay tuned to The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America supports WHYY. Offering clinically qualified cancer patients access to the American Society of Clinical Oncology's TAPER study on the effectiveness of new cancer drugs on specific tumor types. More at cancercenter.com. That's cancercenter.com.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. We've been talking about people coming to this country seeking refuge from all sorts of things: war, oppression, persecution, lack of economic opportunity. One of President Trump's key campaign promises was to stop some of those people from coming into the country. For example, he wants to build a continuous border wall between the U.S. and Mexico. The cost and feasibility of that project are being hotly debated, and a wall could also have unintended consequences, affecting the non-human traffic that crosses that border. Reporter Maya Springhawk Rubnett spent time in the Sonoran Desert. It's a vast expanse of sand, occasional cacti, and cloudless skies that straddles the state of Sonora in Mexico and the southern border of Arizona.
The border region is one of the most diverse wildlife areas in the nation, with about 600 different kinds of animals. But you wouldn't know it standing out here. It's quiet in the desert. There are all sorts of hidden species out here, staying in the shadows, keeping to the brush, from Gila monsters to coyotes to bark scorpions. The loudest animal sound you might hear is the braying of a burro. But like the other desert wildlife, they're skittish of people. So to meet one of these donkeys, I had to head to the outskirts of Yuma, Arizona. Laura Merrill adopts burros as pets.
Do people ever give you funny looks?
When I walk my donkey? Yeah.
When Merrill takes one burro, Sugar, out of the pen, Sunny, the brown one with the white legs, is left behind. Sunny starts whining and then begins running back and forth along the gate. She's looking for a way out to get to her companion. That behavior is indicative of what wildlife experts say happens when animals encounter a barrier. They don't know how to get around it. That's why the proposed uninterrupted concrete wall along the U.S.-Mexico border worries conservationists so much. Being cut off from other animals, food, and water leads to problems. In one case reported by the Sierra Club, a cougar crossed the U.S.-Mexico border before a section of the wall was erected. A male cougar's territory can be dozens of miles wide, so when the wall went up, its habitat was abruptly cut in half. Near Douglas, Arizona, on a foggy morning, I'm standing with three ranchers at the border. Shoulder-high metal sculptures, called a Normandy barrier, cut through the landscape of blue mountains, greenery, and beige land. It's made from posts that look like railroad tracks set in X shapes. It allows most animals through, but it keeps vehicles out and keeps cattle in. 81-year-old Warner Glenn puts his hand on the metal and looks out past the international boundary.
If you jump over this barrier, the first step you'd be still in the U.S., but from then on you'd be in Mexico.
Glenn and his daughter, Kelly Glenn Kimbrough, own the land on the American side. The ranch has been in the family for more than six decades. They're Trump supporters, but...
We don't want a wall. It isn't going to stop 10 people. We saw a funny thing at Walmart in Douglas right after Trump was elected. My daughter and I saw a truck with Sonora license plates going to Mexico with 12 ladders on it. And we were like, oh my gosh, this man's going into business.
Kimbrough says once the wall goes up, he'll be selling those ladders to people in Mexico who want to go over the wall into the U.S. People can climb or tunnel under barriers, but most animals won't be able to dig under the kind of deep foundation needed for a concrete wall. Fifth-generation rancher Bill McDonald heads a group of Douglas rancher conservationists, and he says they're concerned that the proposal for an impenetrable concrete wall, which President Donald Trump has said could be as high as 40 feet tall, will block natural migration corridors.
There's no question about it. There's a big difference between a barrier that has gaps in it that allows wildlife to go through and one that doesn't. I mean, some of them can, you know, fly over it, but if they don't have wings, they're not going to get over this.
Even some animals with wings won't be able to cross. The pygmy owl, an endangered bird small enough to sit in your palm, typically doesn't fly higher than 15 feet. This isn't a new concern for conservationists. In addition to mountains, sand dunes, and other natural barriers along the Arizona border, about 300 of the 375 miles of Arizona's border already has some man-made barrier on it. Wildlife experts say a continuous wall would be even worse. When an animal is injured or struggling near the border, it's often a volunteer like biology professor Cecilia Vahil who comes to the rescue.
This bird was brought in with symptoms of poisoning.
Vahil is caring for a red-tailed hawk at Arizona Western College. People trying to cross the border disrupt habitats and leave behind all sorts of animal hazards, including trash and plastic water bottles. Vahil says she may end up with more animals who need help if President Trump's plan turns into a concrete wall.
You put those walls up and they can't cross-pollinate. They can't pass those genes and mix them up. Once you lose that biodiversity, it affects the population in very devastating ways.
She's talking about fragmentation. That's a disruption where animal groups are split, making it difficult for them to find water or food where they used to. Finding a mate, outside your family group, gets harder too. Displaced animals can begin to inbreed, and that weakens the population. To get a different read on the situation, I met up with Brian Strom, a U.S. Border Patrol agent in the Yuma sector. The agency works to stop illegal immigrants and terrorists from entering the country. But Strom says agents look out for animals too. He doesn't think the current barriers do any harm.
Do I think that we stop wildlife from migrating back and forth from the United States to Mexico? No, I don't. Where there's a will, there's a way. And where we've done environmental impact studies, the right fence is in the right place to allow that to happen.
24 or more environmental laws were waived to put up the existing walls, barriers, and fences. And wildlife watchers like Dan Millis with the Sierra Club in Tucson want more rigorous studies.
For the Border Patrol to say that where there's a will, there's a way is really emblematic of how people respond to the wall, not wildlife. Mountain lions don't throw ropes over the wall. Deer are not able to construct a ladder and go over the wall.
Officials with the U.S. Border Patrol and the Game and Fish Department say they expect to have a say in the construction of any new barrier on the border. And the people I spoke with seem pretty confident it won't be a solid, uninterrupted concrete wall. So until it's set in stone, or cement, the animals of the border, for the most part, remain binational citizens. For The Pulse, I'm Maya Springhawk, Robnett.
Coming to a new country, you tend to miss a lot of things about home. All the things you were familiar with, the landscape, your friends, the language, inside jokes, and the food, especially the food. The taste and smell of home have a magical way of transporting you back and easing that homesick feeling. And for some immigrants, getting that authentic flavor means they have to grow their own familiar food. Here's Catalina Jaramillo.
We're on a big community farm in South Philadelphia looking for African eggplant. Mirtus Monigaba planted the crop last year. He's a refugee from the Democratic Republic of Congo in Central Africa. He was a teacher and a farmer there, and here in the States, he teaches neighbors how to grow their own food.
We are having some here, yes.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, this is the one.
Oh, sorry.
That'd be some good seed out of that one.
It's winter, so mostly everything around us is brown and dead. But we find a dried African eggplant from last summer. Malik Savage knows this kind of eggplant through Mertus. They work together at the farm.
That good stuff, man.
How does it taste?
Like a cucumber.
It's nothing like the big, dark purple eggplant that we know. It's small and oval, so this one actually looks like an egg. This particular variety can be white, green, or yellow. It has lots of common names, and people call it different things in Congo, Burundi, and Rwanda.
Nyanyandole, this is Swahili. And then in Kirundi, we call it Intore. In Kinyarwanda, we call it Ntogi.
Mertus wanted seeds of this eggplant since he arrived in America 2 years ago. You can eat African eggplant raw like a fruit, and he was craving its bitter taste. Then a friend from the Congo who was living in New Hampshire told Mertus he was growing African eggplant from home.
When I heard this, it was so amazing. Is it true that we can get some eggplants here in the USA? It was so amazing.
How did your friend got the seeds?
I think... maybe it might be someone who came with the little seeds in the pocket or somewhere.
Putting little seeds in your pocket, hoping that the customs officer won't notice, Mertus is laughing a little because sneaking seeds into the U.S. without declaring them is not legal. But refugees, especially farmers, take a chance. Julianne Ramage from the Nationality Service Center helps resettle refugees in the U.S. She says clients sometimes become emotional when they first see familiar foods.
You know, food brings them comfort. So being able to have that taste, a taste of home, or to see an ingredient that maybe their grandmother used to cook back home can be very powerful.
The Nationality Service Center operates 2 farms in Philadelphia with 600 garden plots. Refugees grow produce side by side with their neighbors. In addition to the eggplant, there's bitter melon. And Burmese farmers grow roselle. That's a bitter herb used in stir fries and soups. The farm not only provides food, it's also a place to forget about stress.
We have no place where to meet. But here it can be a good place where you come, you do your own thing, and then you can even expect a good friend to be there. If it's someone who can share the same language or same stories, yeah, it feels so wonderful.
At the end of a farm tour, Mertus invites me to his house for Sunday dinner. He wants me to try the way his wife cooks the African eggplant. Obviously, I say yes.
Hey!
Oh. Welcome!
Mertus and his wife Susana have 5 kids. The family escaped civil war in the Congo, where Mertus says they were targeted because of their ethnicity and their political views. After that, the family lived in limbo in a refugee camp in Namibia for 17 years. Susana starts the meal. There are potatoes, fish, and a starch called fufu. While she cooks, we chat about Philadelphia.
Aquí en América es muy boa porque no te guerra.
After an hour of talking, chopping, and seasoning,
the eggplant
is the last thing to hit the pot. Mertus helps set the table. And finally, the children come down to eat. Alpha is the oldest. He's 20.
It looks like it tastes good.
Having eggplant in the middle of the winter is special. These eggplants were frozen from last season. Before we eat, Susana leads a prayer in Swahili. Amen. And then we finally dig in.
Bon appétit.
Merci.
It's so delicious.
Very
good. She cooked like my mother.
When you eat this, what things do you remember?
I remember home for sure. I remember my home. How I used to be in a big family, around a big table like this.
When I eat this food, I remember my grandmother, and then I remember my mom.
The Monigabas were forced out of Congo when Alpha, the oldest, was just a baby. After being in America for 2 years, he's slowly losing his Swahili, but his food memories are still there.
The way I was raised eating this food and still eating it,
in another part of the world, in the United States, it really feels good. So which might help, will help me not to forget, you know, where I came from.
That was Catalina Jaramillo reporting. Let's end today's episode with a poem, writing about your experience being yet another thing that can make people feel at home no matter where they are. Here is Fadi Judeh. He is a Palestinian-American doctor and writer, with one of his poems.
Mimesis. My daughter wouldn't hurt a spider that had nested between her bicycle handles. For 2 weeks, she waited until it left of its own accord. If you tear down the web, I said, it will simply know this isn't a place to call home, and you'd get to go biking. She said, that's how others become refugees, isn't it?
Fadi Judeh is a Palestinian-American doctor and poet living in Houston, Texas. You can find this poem and others in his book, A Light. Let's continue this conversation about seeking refuge and coming to this country online. You can reach us on Twitter. We are at WHYYThePulse, and we've been using the hashtag #SeekingRefuge. Tell us your stories. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, Elizabeth Fiedler, and Alan Yu. We had production help this week from Alex Stern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Tanya English, our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, the executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next time on The Pulse, badass female scientists, their work, their challenges, and the mentors who keep them going.
There have been people paving this path for us for a very long time. And so when you feel defeated, know that there are people who've worked very hard before us, and we can do this standing on the shoulders of people like Zora Neale Hurston.
Even when I would visit her after she turned 100, she would challenge me on my environmental career and long-term goals.
And one woman's quest to change video game culture.
We're an industry that always portrays women as like, damsels in distress or the girlfriend that's been kidnapped.
Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes. And while you're there, leave us a review. Let us know how we're doing. This helps other people find The Pulse, too.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
Penn Medicine's Transplant Institute supports WHYY. Penn has been performing kidney, liver, heart, lung, and pancreas transplants for more than 50 years. Penn offers advanced options to help decrease wait times and improve outcomes. Learn more about all the options to help patients live and thrive at pennmedicine.org/transplant or 800-789-PENN. Because your life is worth Penn Medicine. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.